the heroes of faith listed in chapter 11 of the letter to the Hebrews. And this morning, as I mentioned earlier, we'll be looking at looking at part of the life of Jephthah. If you want to read a little more about this and his story, it begins in Judges 10, verse 6, and runs through to Judges 12, verse 7. He's also mentioned in 1 Samuel, chapter 12, verse 11, where Israel are continuing to ask for a king, and Samuel is reminding them that the Lord has provided numerous people to lead them to victory, including Samson we had last week, Gideon, Barak, Jephthah, and the only king that they need is the Lord himself. Judges, I think we probably covered this a little bit, but Judges is really a good book to read through and see the natural behavior of mankind and really grasp the fact that man is full of sin. Man constantly wants to go his own way rather than follow the Lord. Despite all the Lord has done for mankind, when things appear to be running smoothly, man wastes very little time in forgetting the Lord and following his own selfish and sinful way. Without going through everything that the Lord's done for his people, here are just a few things to remind people. The Lord has struck down Egypt with a series of plagues and disasters. He's rescued Israel from slavery. He's miraculously parted the Red Sea and enabled the Israelites to cross it and escape the chasing Egyptians. He's led them through the desert with clouds and fire. He's provided food and water to sustain them in the desert. He's led them across the Jordan, again enabling them to cross into the land that he's promised. And then he's enabled them to defeat their enemies and take control of this land under the leadership of Joshua. Surely, listing all those miraculous events, surely there's no way that people would forsake the Lord and go their own way. You'd be stupid, wouldn't you? Well, we are. Just one generation after the death of Joshua and his team of elders, we have this statement. Another generation grew up who neither knew the Lord nor what he'd done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, etc., etc., etc. Judges 2, verses 10 to 11 says that. Reading on, as a result of this sinful behavior, they're defeated by their enemies and were living in great distress. In their distress, they would repent and turn back to the Lord and ask him to rescue them. Then the Lord would rise up a judge who would rescue them from their enemies. This picture is repeated time and time again throughout Judges. Chapter 3, verse 7. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and they forgot the Lord their God. Verse 12. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 4, verse 1. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 8, verse 33. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites again prostituted themselves to the Baals and did not remember the Lord their God. So you get the picture. As was mentioned last week by Sarah, in the last verse of Judges, which is chapter 21, verse 25, it sums it all up by saying, in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which he thought was right in his own eyes. So that's the picture that Judges gives you of mankind. Nothing much has changed in 2,000 years. So we get to Judges chapter 10, verse 6. By this point in time, God has so far raised up eight people chosen to deliver Israel from its latest period of wayward behavior and the consequential distress that has caused them. But once again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They served the Baals and a whole load of other gods. And because they forsook the Lord and no longer served him, he put them in the hands of the Philistines and the Amorites. And they were oppressed by the Amorites for a period of 18 years. So we now get to the story of Jephthah. The Israelites are desperate, and again, they recognize their sinful ways, how they've rejected the Lord. So they repent, turn back to the Lord, and plead with him to rescue them. The Ammonites are ready to attack the people of Gilead, and clearly there's great concern, as there appears to be nobody capable of taking on the might of the Ammonites. It's a pretty awful situation to be in. The leaders of the people of Gilead agree amongst themselves that whoever takes a lead in any attack against the Ammonites will be the head of all of Gilead. But at the end of chapter 10, it seems that no clear leader is available. No one has the faith to take on this task. So who will the Lord raise up to rescue his people? This is where Jephthah enters the picture. Jephthah is described as a Gileadite and a mighty warrior, son of Gilead, but he has the sins of his father on his shoulders. He was the illegitimate son of Gilead, born of a prostitute, and clearly not a sound lineage, and clearly not the sort of man you'd expect to lead a nation, or indeed the type of person you'd expect God to choose. When his dad dies, it all comes to a head. He was unceremoniously took out of his dad's family and out of the community. He had to live his life as an outcast with no residual connection with the family or the community. He was completely disregarded, considered a waste of space, rejected, ignored, and not wanted by the community. If you were in his position, that would make you pretty bitter. He hadn't done anything wrong, apparently, apart from being an illegitimate son of his father. Jephthah fled to Tob, and there he gathered a gang of, my Bible says, adventurers. Other Bibles say scoundrels. The Good News Bible says worthless men. Well, I shall think that Jephthah thought he was pretty worthless as well, having been rejected by his community. So he's got this gang of adventurers, I like that phrase. But reading around this, it appears that this gang actually acted to protect the local Israelites. They defended them against the occupying forces. And they would go on raiding parties and generally be a nuisance to the Amorites. A sort of guerrilla warfare, if you like. And so while Jephthah possibly had the right to feel very bitter about his situation and his rejection, apparently he did work to support and defend the local people. It seems to me that it's clear that the leaders of Gilead must have known of Jephthah as well, and also his whereabouts, because when things get desperate and no leader can be found, well, nobody that would be suitable to lead the people of Gilead into war, eventually they give in and go to Tob and seek out Jephthah. So they approach Jephthah and ask him to be their commander. There's no apology, no comment on the way he's been driven out of the community and rejected. And he reminds them how they've treated him. And their response is simply to skip over, and in the NIV, it says they just say, nevertheless, despite this treatment, they're coming now to ask you to lead us and fight the Ammonites and be our leader. Jephthah will have been well versed in the scriptures and would have known the promises of God. He would have therefore expected the Lord to deliver Israel from the oppression of the Philistines and the Ammonites. So his immediate response brings in his faith. And he looks for deliverance from the Lord. And he also tests the mettle of the Gilead leaders. He asks whether, if the Lord gives him victory over the Ammonites, will he truly be made head over all the other leaders? And he made the leaders of Gilead make this promise with the Lord as their witness. Having got this agreement from the leaders of Gilead, he accepts the commission and returns to Gilead with the leaders. And there, before the people of Gilead, the leaders, and himself, he repeats all the words before the Lord at Mizpah. So what we've got here is a situation where the people, the leaders, and Jephthah have made a new commitment to each other and to the Lord. This is a new beginning, and by the grace of God, they can look to a new future. It's time for Jephthah to rise up and be judge and deliverer of his people. So with confidence and faith in the promises of the Lord, Jephthah is bold and confident in the victory. And he gets right down to it. It's a bit funny, actually. If you look back over the weeks we've been studying the sort of heroes of faith, and indeed last year when we started looking at the heroes of faith, God always seems to choose the most unlikely of people to do his work. You could even suggest that more times than not, the person we might choose to do God's work would be the wrong person. Certainly not what God would choose. So we very much need God's guidance in these areas. In particular, when appointing someone to a leadership role in the church, we do need to eliminate any of our own personal prejudices or misconceptions and be open to the guidance of the Lord. It's not easy to do this, but we do need to take time out, pray about these matters, and try to listen to what the Lord is saying to us. Ultimately, any appointment to a leadership role in the church is God's choice, not ours. And we must not be obstacles to the plans of the Lord for our future. Ultimately, the Lord will have his way. If we frustrate his plans, then we'll have to overcome more difficulties, more issues, and have to wait longer for his plans to be fulfilled. For many in the Hall of Fame, we can highlight major flaws. Their characters are not really scrupulous. From a human perspective, we'd always disqualify people from being appointed as a leader because of things that they've done. But God still sees them, lifts them up, and uses them. As with most people, I think Jephthah will have had numerous flaws in his character. But we're not dealing with that particular issue in this passage. His problem relates to the sins of his father. Jephthah is illegitimate, and for this reason, is rejected by his family and his community. But God still lifts him up and uses him in a miraculous way. So let's see what he gets up to. In an attempt to avoid outright war, he sends messengers to the king of the Ammonites and asks what he has against him and his people and why he wants to wage war on them. And the king responds, saying Israel took the land from him when they came out of Egypt and said they should give it back in a peaceful way. But Jephthah knows his history and presents a series of arguments to refute the claims of the Ammonites. In verses 14 to 22, he explains that this isn't the case. When the Israelites left Egypt, they actually avoided entering the lands of Edom and Moab. But the Lord did hand over the land of the Amorites, as opposed to the land of the Amorites to Israel when the Amorites attacked Israel. But he says that the Ammonites had never held possession of the land. So how could he possibly justify the claim that the Israelites are taking over his land? In verses 23 to 24, Jephthah argues on theological grounds that the Lord has driven out the Amorites from the land. So what right does this give the Ammonites to possess it? While not accepting that their God has got any power at all, he taunts the Ammonites that they should place reliance on whatever their God, Chemosh gives them. So they should rely on their God, and wherever their God gives them, they can keep that land. Israel will do likewise. So they shouldn't be trying to take the land that the Lord has given the Israelites. Jephthah then, in verse 25, presents an argument on a case of past precedent. He raises the issue of King Balak of the Moabites, and you find this in Numbers chapters 23 and 24. The King Balak never did physically wage war on the Israelites. He saw that the Lord beat the Amorites who tried to attack the Israelites, and he recognized the power of the Lord. The king of the Ammonites, was he considering himself more powerful than the king of Moab? So really saying, you should not attack God's chosen people because you're doomed to failure. And finally, in verse 26, Jephthah points out that Israel occupied this area for more than 300 years. So everything's been nice and settled. If the Ammonites had an argument with this particular piece of land belonging to the Israelites, why had they not done something about it in the last 300 years? So after Jephthah's raised all these arguments and points out the Ammonites are wrong in going to war, in verse 27 he decides, let's leave it to the Lord to decide. He will judge the dispute between the Israelites and the Ammonites. And that is where we rejoin the reading at verse 28, because the king of the Ammonites pays no attention to the justification that Jephthah, to Jephthah's arguments. A war is inevitable. At this point, the Spirit of the Lord falls on Jephthah. He knew the Lord was with him. He must have been confident in victory, and emboldened by this, the Spirit of the Lord driving him forward, he advanced towards the Ammonite forces. So what happens as the battle gets closer? Does he suddenly lose a crisis of faith? I find this very difficult to understand. At this point, this is the point where Jephthah makes a vow to the Lord. He knows he's got victory, but he makes his vow to the Lord. If you give me the Ammonites, give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice as a burnt offering. The Spirit of the Lord was with him. Victory was already assured. His faith had carried him this far. He had no need to make a vow. I guess it was either a wobble of faith or perhaps a belt and braces type of thing that he wanted to make absolutely sure. But somewhere he had a wobble. His faith failed him slightly there. And as we know, the Lord did indeed give the Israelites a miraculous victory over the Ammonites. Israel had been totally suppressed by the Ammonites for the past 18 years. And led by the person that the Lord raised up, the person who had been totally rejected by his community, the outcast, the worthless person, Jephthah, gives the people an overwhelming victory via the Lord. Whatever the reason, Jephthah had been foolish in making an unnecessary vow. And as I mentioned earlier, the reason for the change in the meaning of his name from he opens to a man of the foolish vow, it perhaps even accounts for the fact that Jephthah isn't a very popular name at the moment. I tried to look up where in the sort of sequence of most used names Jephthah landed. Was it in the top 10, the top 100? Didn't appear at all. Perhaps that's the reason why he's so foolish. So as I said earlier, on his triumphant return from battle, it's his only child, his daughter, that comes running out of the house to greet him. And his triumph goes in an instant. He realizes his foolishness. He's devastated. But do note, there's no question of him not fulfilling his vow. He was foolish to make the vow, but he didn't try to excuse himself when he found out the true cost. I think his daughter takes things rather well. All she asks for is a couple of months' freedom with her friends to weep because she will never marry. So it sounds fairly harsh, this, but I won't go into how the vow was fulfilled, because there's an awful lot of different views on it. But the favoured view is that human sacrifice was considered abominable in the Jewish law at that time, and it would have been forbidden. And as such, offering your daughter as a literal burnt offering would not have been allowed. What's more likely is that it would have been a symbolic burnt offering, and his daughter would have been fully dedicated to the Lord as a living sacrifice. And this would mean a full loss of Jephthah's future and any hope of having a family line to carry on his name. So it was still a heavy price to pay. She would have to live a life fully dedicated to the Lord. So there's clear lessons to be learned here. Keep your eyes fixed on the Lord and trust in him to look after you. Don't make vows. You've no idea what the future holds or what the true cost of making a vow would be. And if you do make a vow, you need to fulfill it. So be very careful when making vows. But we've covered that already. Even after this victory that he's had, Jephthah's problems are still not over. If you read on in the next chapter, the tribe of Ephraim start kicking off because he went to war without them. They couldn't find a leader to start off with. Now they're saying, you went to war without us. How dare you? This tribe thought of themselves as special and worthy of some sort of special place of honour. And they felt they'd been treated wrongly by not being properly consulted in this campaign against the Ammonites. So Jephthah then had to fight this tribe as well, effectively fighting his own people. And it's quite a tragic thing. But after that, Jephthah was judged over all of Israel for a period of 6 years, at which time he died. But soon, you'll find, you read on through Judges, the cycle of the Israelites going their own way and start again. So how can we pull all this together? Well, the issue of making vows and promises has probably already been well covered. But I think the key message is here, if we feel completely rejected by our friends or our family, don't forget the Lord has a special place for each one of us. If we stand on the promises of the Lord, he's able to use us in the most miraculous and amazing ways. I'm not saying that we'll be used to save a nation from being oppressed, but the Lord loves each one of us, and he has a plan for us, and he will lift us up. So if this morning you feel abandoned or rejected or alone in this world, then turn to the Lord for your salvation.